Well, good morning. It's good to have the opportunity to share God's word with you this morning, even if the particular circumstances of me being here rather than Julian preaching are not so good. I received a phone call from him yesterday afternoon, and he didn't sound very well. He is actually here this morning, but I did remember that I had said to him maybe more than once, if he ever wanted someone to preach at short notice, I was willing. And of course, the great thing about preaching at short notice is you don't have the sermon hanging over you all week. I really do admire those who manage to live that way, and you have a very good excuse for your lack of preparation. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to be looking at the same passage that Julian had set for us, Genesis chapter 9. He had the title Understanding Rainbows, but we've already had those explained. So I'll deal a little bit with rainbows, but we're going to be going through in a series. If you're visiting today, it's great to have you with us. You're really welcome. What we like to do in our church is go through a book of the Bible systematically, so one bit after another, partly to restrain ourselves from just preaching on the bits we most like or which are easiest. And so that's what we're going to do today. So if you're unfamiliar with this book, it's the book of the Bible. You can find these really brightly coloured ones nearby. And we're in Genesis chapter 9. And so far what's happened is God has made the world, the first couple of chapters of the Bible, and he made it good. Then chapter 3, humans decided to disobey God's command. And then things have gone from bad to worse, murder, death, violence, till the point when God judges the world with a great flood. It's almost like an uncreation of what he has made. However, God chooses Noah and seven of his family members and animals along with him to go into a large boat or ark to be kept safe. And so we pick up the story at the time when the flood has dried up and they're going to come out. So let's start by reading actually from the end of chapter 8, Genesis chapter 8, verse 20 through to 9, verse 6. We've had the rest of it read for us already. Genesis 8, verse 20. This is God's word. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. The Lord smelt the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of the humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease." Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you will fall on all the beasts of the earth and on the birds of the sky, on every creature that moves along the ground, and on all the fish in the sea. They're given into your hands. Everything that lives and moves about will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal and from every human being too. I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made mankind." We're going to look at this passage under four headings, and the way I'm going to divide up the text is simply to notice that basically from about 8 verse 21 through to 9 verse 17 is all God speaking right the way through, and yet what the passage does, it actually breaks it up several times and reintroduces God as the speaker. So it will say in 8 verse 21 that God spoke, but then again in 9 verse 1, and again in 9 verse 8, and then again in 9 verse 12. So that's the way I'm going to break up the passage, and I take the final thing in 9 verse 17 as really just a concluding statement. So we're going to look at this under four headings. And the first heading is this, from 8:20 through to 8:22, that God will not curse again. That God will not curse again. It begins with Noah offering sacrifices. Of course, it's a good thing he brought seven of some sorts of animal onto the ark in order to have some spare, the clean animals, and he offers them up for an offering to God. It's in fact the first altar recorded in the Bible, even though one might be implied in chapter 4. And it seems to have an extraordinary effect on God. I mean, God is described in a unique way here in the Bible as smelling the sacrifice and seemingly, you know, being pleased and almost changing what he does. You might think it's a rather primitive and crude view of God, as if, you know, you offer up to the gods what they like and they all get all happy and high on whatever you've just offered them. But that won't do as an understanding of what's going on here. Because, of course, the Bible has many opportunities to talk about God eating sacrifices and needing them in order to survive, and it seems to pass them all up. What's more, it's not that because Noah offers this sacrifice, he gets lots of favor with God, because Noah, according to the book, already had favor with God. Right at the beginning of the flood, chapter 6 and verse 8, we're told that Noah had God's favor on him. So it's not that he was like out of favor, offers a sacrifice, and then is in favor. He's not trying to curry favor with God. Rather, after the sacrifice, God makes a promise for the whole of human benefit, in fact, for the whole earth. So when we see the way God is presented, we see that God is in charge of everything, and yet he also responds to what humans do. And those are the two things that we've got to hold in tension as we read through the Bible. Now, there are two errors that people can often fall into when they look at the Bible. One is to think that God's so in charge that what humans do doesn't matter. And he just, you know, keeps on rolling on, and it really doesn't matter what we do. The other fault is to see God as sort of flip-flopping between, you know, different moods depending on what we do. And one day he has a good mood and one day he has a bad mood. In fact, this passage strikes a perfect balance, because what we see is that although God really does respond to Noah's sacrifice, and that's one way that the Bible is going to be teaching us how important sacrifice is, which helps provide a category for our minds as we get on to the sacrifice of God's own Son, Jesus Christ, on the cross, we also see how constant God is. He's going to guarantee day and night, summer and winter, and it's not going to depend on moods of God. No, God is completely faithful. And that's one of the things we're really going to be celebrating this morning. God is completely faithful. So God is constant. And what he says here is that as a result of this sacrifice, he is not again going to curse the ground. Now, automatically when we hear curse the ground, and we've been reading through Genesis, we go back to the other passages where it's been talking about cursing the ground. And this is where we learn one of the rules that runs through Genesis. You can't curse what's been blessed, and you can't bless what's been cursed by God. And the reason why is simply this, because when God decrees things, that's what's going to happen. So one of the odd things you might not have noticed in Genesis 1 is that the land animals are not blessed. I don't know whether you've ever noticed that. The land animals are not blessed. I don't think it's because land animals aren't blessed, but simply because in Genesis chapter 3, the serpent is going to be cursed. And so in order not to have a contradiction between those two, the land animals are not blessed. But maybe give you a clearer example. In Genesis 9 verse 1, we read that God blesses Noah and his three sons, right? Then one of his sons, Ham, does something wrong. What's wrong, Julian will explain next time. But the point is that when Noah responds to that, he doesn't curse Ham, because Ham's already been blessed. He, in fact, curses Ham's son, Canaan. And Julian can explain all about that as well. So I'm loading up work for him. This is a principle that, in fact, you can find all sorts of places in the Bible. Think of Numbers. There's a man called Balaam who is hired by a nearby king to try and curse Israel. And the problem is, for him, that God's already blessed Israel. And so every time, you know, he tries to curse, it doesn't work out. So in other words, there's this principle running through. And here we have something going on again, that the curse of the earth isn't rescinded. It's not uncursed, but God says he's not going to curse again. This is what he says in verse 8:21. Let's read it again. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. Never again will I destroy all living creatures as I've done." In other words, God's not going to effect a curse like he did wiping things out with a flood. Never again. And there is a fulfillment there of what you found at the end of chapter 5, if you'd been reading through Genesis. Because there was a boy born called Noah. And Noah's dad said this of Noah. He called him Noah because he will comfort us in the labor and painful toil of our hands caused by the ground that the Lord has cursed. I don't think it's by accident he goes on to agriculture later. But the point is this, that what we see is God is not going to curse again. That's God's wonderful promise. Now, this is how we see God's rather different from humans. Because humans sort of have moods. And when they have moods, when you're in a good mood, you forget all the bad things. And when you're in a bad mood, you forget all the good things. I mean, does anyone find it a bit like that? Yeah? What God does at this point, he smells the sacrifice, he's pleased, and he promises he will never again curse the ground. But has he forgotten what humans are like? Not at all. It says in the passage, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. In other words, in full knowledge of how bad we are, God has said he's not going to judge again like that. In fact, the verdict we have on the human nature after the flood is just the same as was described before the flood in chapter 6, verse 5, where we find this rather dire description of human evil, which we need to think about because it doesn't quite correspond with the sort of feelings of kindness we often get as we meet random people. So let's think about what that means. Of course, what it's not saying is that humans are as bad as they possibly could be, because one of the things we experience is God's faithfulness, his grace, his common grace, which means that even though what we tend to invent is turning away from God, what God does also is restrain us, and there is so much good in the world as a result. And so God makes this wonderful promise that as long as earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. Now, he doesn't guarantee four seasons, just two. And what we'll see is four chapters later, there's going to be a famine. It's not promising that everything is going to be just all right. But God guarantees his constancy in upholding the created order. And I see in this a little picture of what we have in the Christian message as a whole. God knows how bad we are, and yet even so, he's prepared to extend extraordinarily generous, unconditional promises on the basis of sacrifice. Now, of course, it's a small and incomplete picture, because what Noah is doing in sacrificing is just a foreshadowing, a pale picture of what I think the Bible points to with its great sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So that's what we learn from the first section, that God won't curse again. That's a bit negative, isn't it, I suppose? But it's still an amazing thing. God won't curse again the stability of the earth. But then we come on to the next section, chapter 9, verse 1 through to 7. God blesses. So, first section, God won't curse again. The next section, God blesses. He begins blessing Noah and his sons. I've already explained about how blessing works in the Bible. Now, if Noah and his three sons are blessed, that is rather positive for the whole human race. I mean, it's not that no one could ever be cursed, but what we can say is everyone is descended from people who are blessed. And that blessing, of course, isn't just on them, because when God blesses Abraham, it's for future generations as well. Humanity as a whole, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, is blessed. Which is why, even though our hearts are so evil, we do experience so much good in life, as God's restraining grace is there. So we see the Christian understanding of humans as so turning to evil and yet as blessed by God. And then we have this command that they should be fruitful and multiply, increasing number, the first command, in fact, given to humans. Now, I had a friend who was an academic, Christian academic, in a debate recently with a secularist. And a friend of mine reported the strange turn of events that happened in this debate, that basically the secularist had been attacking Christianity on the basis that Christianity is one of those things that believes everyone should be so fruitful and multiplying that that causes overpopulation and is bad for the environment. And that was the basic line of attack. I heard another friend recently telling me of an incident as they went through an airport and they were struggling to get their children through airport security, and the airport security guard said to them, "I don't feel sorry for anyone who's chosen to have children." And there we have. Now, of course, if they'd harassed someone else, that might have been more difficulty. But what we do find is hints of in our society, not very explicit all the time, of a negative attitude to those who have children. And, of course, we've been celebrating this morning, Carmen, and we believe and we want to affirm just how wonderful it is to have children. But we do need to think about this whole populationist issue here. Firstly, we need to consider it as a theme within the Bible. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth is something that was said back in Genesis chapter 1. But then what happens if we read Genesis 6 is we see that humans did multiply, Genesis 6 verse 1, and then Genesis 6 verse 11, the earth was filled, but not with humans, but with violence. In other words, these words come again, and then what we see is, as a result, what multiplied was not humans, but water. Those are the phrases, the same words that occur through this passage. So the passage makes us reflect on the fact that, well, other things can fill the earth as well. Violence and the sign of judgment. Now, I can understand that with just over 7 billion people on the planet and the UN's high, they've got various estimates of population growth through the 21st century, but one estimate being 16 billion people on the planet by 2100. Everyone says 2100, is that what it'll be called? I don't know, won't be there. But anyway... So people can be concerned about overpopulation on the planet and the environmental damage caused by that. And people might point to verses like this and say, well, that should be blamed. But this verse does not say that we should overfill the earth, but rather that we should make it full, which is different. And as for environmental damage, there's nothing worse for the environment than sin. Nothing worse for the environment than sin. I mean, if there were no greed, selfishness, wars... we wouldn't be in a bad place, would we? Many of us, in fact, have jobs in sin-related industries. I mean, I'm not saying sinful jobs, but I mean, you know, some police or working as locksmiths or internet security and so on. So much of what we do can be actually related to preventing and dealing with the consequences of sin. When the Bible talks about what destroys the earth, it's very interesting that the phrase people destroying the earth does occur in the Bible. In the book of Revelation, very much using some of the same language as we find in Genesis, but Revelation verse 11:18 and 19 verse 2, you can see actually sin destroying the earth, people's sin. So if I were pressed by a secularist on this point, I'd want to acknowledge their concern. It's a legitimate concern. But I'd also want to raise a greater concern, namely the concern about sin. And Christians are against it, even though we do it, if you see what I mean. Now, there's another extraordinary thing in this passage, and the extraordinary thing for this, for me, is this. God, who knows how evil we are, should encourage us to multiply. I mean, isn't that just very counterintuitive? Because isn't that like the surest way to make sure there's more sin around? I mean, if we're sinful, more of us means more sin, doesn't it? I mean, if humans hadn't worked out right, why have any more? Why not just wipe the whole lot out? I mean, forget about the ark. I mean, just blitz the lot. Why have any more humans? Now, of course, it's always difficult to answer why did God questions. Because lots of why did God questions we don't know the answer to, because his ways are so much higher than our ways, how can we possibly work them out? And if he hasn't told us, don't try and answer a why did God question. But it does remind me, in Isaiah chapter 11, there is a vision of the end times. There's a vision of the wolf lying down with the lamb with a peaceful time. And this is what it says, Isaiah chapter 11, verse 9. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now, we've just been seeing how water's covered rather a lot. And here we're going to have, in the future, the earth being filled with the knowledge of the Lord. In other words, God seems to want the earth to be filled with people, because he wants lots of people knowing him and praising him. He has a good destiny for humanity. That's why he hasn't given up on us. Then in verse 2, he addresses the relationship between humans and animals. That relationship is disturbed, and animals can now be food. They live in fear, rather a contrast with Genesis chapter 1. Now, a text like this clearly teaches us that it is legitimate for people now to eat meat. It's equally clear, I think Julian said it was a dodgy meat pie, is that right? Equally clear that there can be negative effects to eating meat, which afflicted our pastor and meant that you're getting this sermon rather than his one this morning. So there are these considerations, but what we are told is there is a restriction, a very specific restriction. The restriction is on blood. Don't eat with the blood. Why have that sort of restriction? Why does the Old Testament make such a big thing about it? It connects blood and life, as we do so often today. And it does it for a specific teaching purpose. The more we see blood as special, the more we're going to understand the sacrifice of Christ. Because a lot of what's going on in the Old Testament is preparing the mental categories for us to be able to understand Christ when he comes. Now, one of the really bizarre things that's talked about is blood as somehow cleansing. Blood is somehow taking away sin. It's a very strange cleaning agent. But it makes you realize just how serious sin is, that there's no other price that can be paid for it than blood. So whether it's an animal that kills a human or a human that kills a human, God's justice demands that they forfeit their lives. Because humans are so significant, they're in the image of God, verse 6. And those principles are enshrined in Old Testament law, both the laws about what happens if animals, an ox gores a human, or if a human kills a human. We don't tend to gore, do we? But there we are. Now, obviously, this has been a prime text, Genesis 9, verse 6, being used in support of having the death penalty, and we can see exactly why. Because the passage tells us how terrible it is that anyone should take away someone's life, and therefore, what else could be an adequate punishment for that? Now, I don't think that this forces us to, as Christians, believe that every society should have the death penalty, because after all, you'd need to have a justice system that would be adequate for it. This passage also tells us it'd be terrible if someone took someone's life which was innocent. But what we can at least say is that those who've taken other people's lives have forfeited their own right to life. They have no reason to complain if others take their life away. The passage teaches us that nothing other than life itself can pay for the taking of a human life. And then what's surprising is that this section ends, after all of this seeming negativity about the relationship with the animals and about humans' relationship with each other, again by repeating that command to be fruitful, increase in number, multiply on the earth, and increase upon it. Verse 7. So the first point, 8:23-22, was that God won't curse again. The next point, chapter 9, verses 1 to 7, is that God blesses. The third section is that God makes a covenant. Chapter 9, verses 8 through to 11. God knows how bad humans are, and yet he wants them to multiply. And then in this extraordinary way, he unilaterally makes a covenant with Noah. Now, covenant's a bit of an odd word. You might use it in some legal settings today, but otherwise it can seem a little bit old. And Noah is the first person to receive a covenant in the Bible, so we need to think about this. What is a covenant? Well, you could think of other words that might capture some of it. A treaty, an agreement, a contract. But it's a bit special in this case. Often, in the ancient world, you could have a treaty between two kings. You could have a treaty in which they treat each other as equals. Or you could have a treaty in which one is a superior king and the other is their vassal. The surprising thing here is that God is the superior and that he binds himself unilaterally to do something for humans, the inferior. You see, what would happen in the ancient Near East is if you had
you know, a big cheese king and a little cheese king, then the big cheese king makes the little cheese king to say all of the things that he will commit to the big cheese king. I mean, that's the way it works. You know, that's the way society works. The really important person makes all of the demands from the unimportant person. But what is going on here is quite different. God, who is sovereign, makes a covenant with Noah and with his descendants and with the animals. It even describes it as a covenant with the earth. God unilaterally says that he will never again destroy the earth by a flood. There won't be any flood of that kind again that destroys the earth. Now, of course, there are major disasters. Tsunamis, natural disasters. And sometimes people worry about what humans could do. When I was growing up in the 1980s, ages me, doesn't it? You know, people were all into thinking whether they needed to build sort of nuclear bunkers under the stairs in their houses. Do you remember that sort of period, anyone? That was the really big concern. And of course, there are many, many doomsday scenario films today where almost all of humanity has died out in some great cataclysm. Now, we as Christians don't deny in any way the potential for humans, with their technology and their sin, to do that sort of doomsday scenario. But what we do say this, is that the world is in God's hands. We should be vigilant in security, but we should not be anxious as if God is not in control and the world might undergo some destruction before the final end that he's decreed. God has made a solemn commitment that he won't again judge the earth by flood in that way. Now imagine the Queen made some unilateral contract with you. I mean, has anyone ever heard of the Queen having a contract with someone? I mean, we might do some treaty with another country, but I mean, like taking out a contract with a private individual and offering them something unilaterally, it's just extraordinary. But then what we have here is God doing that even though he knows the evil of our hearts. So think of, you know, someone like the Queen knowing someone's criminal record, knowing that they have such a tendency, an ongoing tendency to evil, again making solemn commitments to them. It's simply extraordinary. And that's what we have with God. God making a covenant with us. Now, covenant is also an important thing for us to think about today, because covenant is so important in marriage. It's one of the contexts in which we talk about marriage, and there's a lot of confusion nowadays about what marriage is. And I've been trying to think about why this is. Why, I mean, basically we've got tons of different definitions of marriage going on in different people's minds. But one of the things that's happening is, of course, it's possible now for people to enter a state called marriage with no covenant at all. Does that make sense? It's sort of, it's seen as a sort of legal state you enter into, whereas in the Bible, what happens is people covenant. They make solemn commitments to each other, and the marriage is something that arises out of that. In other words, we need to recover this concept of covenant, this binding agreement that we can make as we promise to another person unconditionally. So we have a wonderful thing here that God introduces covenant to us as an example, and he has made a solemn commitment that he will preserve the earth until its time has come. But then we have more. So the first section, God isn't going to curse again. The next section, he's going to bless. The next section, he makes a covenant. And then we see what's even more extraordinary on top of all of these things. Fourth section, verses 12 through to 17, he gives a sign of the covenant. He doesn't just say he's not going to curse anymore and bless, and then make a generous covenant. He actually makes a sign. That's the rainbow. Now, you would have thought this passage would be rather different. I mean, what it really ought to say is this. I'm going to put the rainbow there, and you're going to see it, and you're going to remember my covenant with you. But it doesn't say that. It says, the rainbow is going to remind God. When I see it, I will remember. Not when you see it, you will remember. When I see it, I will remember. Verses 15 and 16. That's rather striking, because I thought God had a perfect memory. And so when you have all power and a perfect memory, why do you need a reminder? And it sort of reminded me of Hebrews chapter 6. Hebrews chapter 6 is an interesting passage where it's talking about God making a solemn oath to Abraham, and he's thinking, what shall I swear by? Now, that's difficult, because you can't swear by something lower than you. So he swears by himself, right? God takes an oath by himself. And it says, so that you could know with absolute security by two things that can't be changed. One is God, and the other one is God's oath. In other words, I mean, one of those, enough, was complete security, right? And he's given you not just that, but he's given you a completely secure oath as well. Now, I would have thought that God's normal memory operations ought to be enough for us to be secure that he is going to remember. But he's decided, in addition to his normal divine complete memory operations, to add an additional memory operation, which is a reminder to God not again to flood the earth. So if you're really worried about that, don't. God is going to remember. There's a sort of redundancy here, isn't there? Super redundancy. God's extravagance, and that's the way God works. And he gives us this sign. It's called a reminder to God. He's going to remember. It's a sign for us. It's not the last time we'll see signs of covenant. There's another sign of covenant a few chapters later when there's a covenant with Abraham and you have the sign of circumcision. So God does all of these gracious things. Not curse, bless, given a covenant, give a sign of a covenant, fully knowing the evil of the human heart, even knowing what Noah and his and others are going to do. And that's the same God we have today. The same justice of God is demanded. The principles of justice and judgment which brought on the flood. The same God who knows our sin and yet graciously deigns to have dealings with us. Now, have you ever had the feeling that God should have given up on you? Has anyone had that feeling? I've had that feeling quite a few times. I mean, shouldn't he have given up and walked away by now after all I've done? Why is he having anything to do with me? I mean, couldn't he just start up with someone else? I mean, why keep on the human race when he knows the evil of their hearts? And yet this is the God we have to deal with. It reminds me again of another passage from the New Testament, Romans chapter 5. This is what it says in verse 6. While we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly, fully knowing how bad we were. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person, one would even dare to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since, therefore, we have now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved by him from the wrath of God? In other words, that very passage talks about how Christ's own blood, that costly thing, is used to redeem us from the wrath of God. The wrath of God is real. We deserve punishment. There is nothing other than the sacrifice of human life which can take away our sin. That's one of the things and principles we see in this passage. But when we compare this covenant with Noah with the new covenant, the New Testament, what's the sign of the covenant there? The sign of the covenant, well, when Christ is eating a meal with his disciples, he takes the bread and breaks it and he gives them wine. And he says that these signs symbolize his broken body, his blood poured out. In other words, the deal that God makes, knowing how bad we are, is to give his own son. His own son gives his own life for us. The passage tells us how humans are so evil, and yet God's grace keeps on going on. And yet we know that the principles of justice are there all the time with the flood. And the logical all of that implies that God's grace cannot be cheap. And as we read on in the Bible, we see that indeed, grace is not cheap. It cost Christ his own life and that supreme sacrifice he made at the cross. And because of that, God's ongoing grace, It's not cheap, but for us, it's free. And that's really wonderful. And that means that the principles we see in seed in this passage are worked out so much more clearly as we read on in the New Testament. God is completely faithful. We have been faithless. And the great news is this morning, if you're a Christian, that God just keeps on being faithful. We can celebrate. I mean, the wonderful songs we've been singing have been God's faithfulness. I think it's just about the best theme you can imagine. Because as we consider how rotten we are and how we tend to turn away from God, to know that he's just there standing waiting for us to turn back to him. On the other hand, if you're not a believer this morning and may have seen a bit strange and lots of references to bits of the Bible, maybe you hadn't read or considered, I just want to commend to you the God of the Bible. This is a God of complete justice, a God who also makes commitments to humans that he doesn't need to make. He is superabundantly generous and superabundantly faithful. And that faithfulness is not something that's ever going to fade. You're going to find all sorts of disappointment when you encounter many different humans and relationships in the world. But what you will not find is disappointment from this God, and I'd really commend him to you. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for your word to us. And we thank you for your abundant generosity, faithfulness, kindness, and that you just keep on making abundant promises to us. We thank you especially for Jesus Christ and the sacrifice that he made on the cross. Lord, go with us all now and bless us as we seek to serve you. In Christ's name, amen.